This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, welcome to Thursday. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Coming your way this hour, we're going to be joined by Ambassador Michael Oren, former Israeli ambassador to the United States. We'll Zoom that so you'll be able to see it. And you'll also be able to see this if you're Zooming on Zoom now. Or, excuse me, watching the feed. Because Todd Lyons, the acting ICE director, is also in studio. President of the United States has got a busy day. He's going to be welcoming President Erdogan of Turkey to the White House. Maybe he wants to ask him why he keeps on buying Russian oil and why he uses their missile defense system, but he wants F-35s. So we'll see how that meeting goes, and we'll carry the press conference after. Before we get to the acting ICE director, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
By the way, another piece of what is unprecedented and a bit historical about that race, it is the closest presidential race in the 21st century in terms of the outcome.
Not true, not close to being true. Kamala's book tour reminds us daily how lucky we are that she lost, as she struggles to communicate her own story while alienating her own party and former boss.
Number two.
Well, it certainly is a switch from the position that President Trump earlier took with regard to Ukraine's prospects in the war with Russia. You recall he's changed his tune completely, and now he says not only that, that they can win the war and drive Russia out of the territory it has conquered since the invasion.
It's a change. It's a massive change, and it's a welcome one. Donald Trump kicks Putin to the curb and goes all in for Ukraine. How this could actually save the West, but does he risk splitting his party?
Number one.
Masked men jumping out of unmarked cars, people disappearing, no due process, no oversight, zero accountability, happening in the United States of America today. People ask, well, is authoritarianism, you're being hyperbolic? Bull, we're being hyperbolic.
He's being hyperbolic, disingenuous. He's an actor posing as a governor. ICE under attack. More shootings, more protests, more irresponsible Democratic fear-mongering on the agents that have them in severe danger while they try to take the dangerous illegals off the streets. Case in point, the attack in Dallas on Wednesday. And with that, Mr. Director Todd Lyons, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
We end the show yesterday with a shooting. We hear about a sniper on a building next door taking aim at an ICE facility. What could you tell us that has developed since? It's been 24 hours.
Yeah, so we've been really focused on really trying to drill down and work with the FBI, figure out who this guy is, right? Figure out why he was doing that. Obviously, Director Patel posted those photos yesterday that that showed the anti-ICE rhetoric written on those shell casings, right?
It literally said anti-ICE. It's not a nuance.
No, and you know, it's not hyperbole, right? It's clear as day, spelled out right there on the shell casings. And when you look at what he did, he fired so many rounds into the building itself, right? And then he didn't even know there were detainees in that vehicle. He was just shooting because they were ICE vehicles. Detainees weren't even out of the vehicle.
You know, that's who was hit.
Three detainees were hit. One unfortunately died. Two are in critical condition. But he was just firing into ICE vehicles. He wasn't aiming specifically at the detainees. His target was ICE. And it's proven by the amount of rounds he put into the building and vehicles.
And Todd, Mr. Director, do you feel as though Dallas has been a problem? Like, do your agents have told you that they're getting a lack of cooperation in that city?
No, actually, Dallas has been a great cooperation. Dallas County Sheriff's a great partner. We get a lot of arrests out of there. They turn people over to us. Texas Department of Public Safety, great partners. I have no idea why the ICE office has been targeted almost three times now. Almost a month to the day, we had that bomb threat. A gentleman came to the building saying he had a bomb strapped to him. July 4th, he had the ambush, the military-style ambush of ICE officers at the El Dorado facility, just 40 minutes outside Dallas. It's really getting bad.
Do you have a consistency to it? Is there a consistency to the attacks, the types of people that are doing it or financing behind it?
You know, we're seeing obviously an increase, right? Starts off with threats, starts off with just resisting arrest, to now ambush-style attacks. Now we're in a sniper attack in a major city. You know, we're working hard because that's what we want to do. We want to track the money that's funding these people, right? We obviously see a theme. A lot of it's left-leaning that we're seeing a lot of the rhetoric coming from. And that's what we need to focus on.
You know what's so interesting? I talked to you, and I want to talk to you about how you're getting illegal immigrants out of the country. But I find myself talking to you a lot about attacks on your agency before they can do it.
Right.
I mean, you're instead of you answering questions about investigating on the subjects, We're talking about investigating attacks on you. Did you anticipate this?
No. No, I never anticipated. With the way the many, so many people in, you know, the American population voted for President Trump's vision of taking the worst of the worst out of the communities, I never thought I would have to send more law enforcement to secure law enforcement agents doing a law enforcement mission.
So here is a little of what the how the politicians are making everything worse. Cut five.
Donald Trump's modern-day Gestapo is scooping folks up off the streets.
We are not used to our government censoring, chilling speech, disappearing people.
This is Gestapo-like behavior, where plainclothes officers wearing masks are terrorizing immigrants.
So when you hear that, don't you think that does logic tell you that relates to the amplification of attacks on your guys?
100%. You know, to me, that's just vile and disgusting. They're villainizing the men and women of ICE. You know, they say plainclothes officers jumping out of a van. We post on our social media page the worst of the worst. We post those arrests we're making. The officers are clearly marked, vest, their badges, identifying what agency they're with. And you know what? They wouldn't have to wear the masks if people like that or elected officials weren't calling us Nazis, Gestapos, calling for threats like that, calling for people to actively resist us. Elected officials shouldn't do that.
So, you know, pretty much in 2020, there were a lot of idiots and irresponsible people saying defund the police, reimagine police. And James Carville, Democrat, came out and said, this is probably the worst thing I've ever heard any political party get behind. And they have since denied it. But is there anything? I think this is worse. Do they not understand that these are law enforcement officials? They're Americans trying to get illegal immigrants out of our country or find out what their visa status is and see where they belong?
No, and that's a frustrating thing, Brian, is they don't take the time to educate themselves on who are actually arresting. ICE hasn't changed their tactics since the Biden administration, President Obama's administration. We're still doing the same law enforcement mission.
They were scaling you down. Didn't Biden come in and knock your numbers down?
Yeah, our recruiting was down. We couldn't backfill positions. We didn't have enough officers to address the threats. But now that we're actually out there, now that we're actually being allowed to do our law enforcement mission, they're frustrated with it.
Why are you wearing masks? Gavin Newsom's quote was, what are they afraid of?
We're afraid of the threats that his type
In fact,
of rhetoric.
Here's exactly what he said a couple of days ago. I thought about you. Watch this.
It's like a dystopian sci-fi movie. Unmarked cars, people in masks, people quite literally disappearing, no due process, no rights. This is a disgrace. This is an outrage, what we have allowed to happen in this country. ICE, unmask. What are you afraid of? What are you afraid of? What are you afraid of?
Does he know better? Is he there for the applause line? Does he not understand why it's necessary? Why don't you tell him?
He doesn't understand it because the threats and the doxing came out of his state. We did an operation with the Secret Service in Los Angeles where they were doxing ICE agents, putting their families, their kids' Instagrams on telephone poles, calling them out for targets in danger. That's why we're doing it. We didn't have to wear masks in the past. It wasn't until this rhetoric started, Nazis, Gestapos, the threats against us, did we have to start doing that.
Masks suck. We all know this in the country. Nobody wants to wear. I mean, there's some people that still want to wear them, like Ben Affleck's daughter at the UN. But most people, nobody wants to wear a mask. So if you ask these guys, they got to be lean. Everything's got to be tight. They don't want anything on them. They don't need to wear. They much rather not wear masks.
No.
You could still see their badges, right?
You still see their badges. You know, their badge number is clearly visible. You see police ICE or police ATF. You know, Brian, it's not even ICE. It's the FBI's having to do it now. ATF's having to do it because there's such this rhetoric just against law enforcement about people doing the mission. But again, we're out there arresting really bad people. You know, in Chicago, when they're blocking us from trying to make an arrest or...
They were doing that.
Yeah.
Tell people what happened over the weekend.
So over the weekend, we've had people protesting, slashing tires. They tried... We had elected officials trying to block our vehicle that had a guy in it that did 9 years in prison for strangulation, domestic violence, multiple... assault on people, but that's the people they want to try to free and get out of those vans.
Do you think it's like when you know what it's like when someone loses their temper and you know, even a bar or whatever, and would you look at this and go, this is organized? They've done their research. They know where we're going to be. They're almost ahead of it. They seem to be coordinated.
100%, Brian. No, we saw these protests in Chicago. It wasn't people just out there, First Amendment. If you're going to go out there and peacefully protest, then why are you transporting in shields, bats, rocks, CS gas, right? That's not First Amendment. That's not sticking up for your right to free speech. That's out there. You want to battle with the cops and make a statement.
So how did D.C. work for you guys?
D.C. worked great. The combined effort, that whole government, President Trump's vision of making D.C. safe again, it was amazing.
You made them transfer to a sanctuary city, though.
We did. We did.
No, and you got rid of the sanctuary city because
federal. We did. And they worked side by side with us. We were out with the Metropolitan Police Department, the Transit Police, as they're encountering these criminal aliens. And, you know, the cops on the ground, they know. It's these habitual offenders that they see going through the turnstile of detention that could be turned over to us that caused them problems daily. They were happy to turn them over to us now.
So I remember in Los Angeles, if I remember correctly, a couple of months ago when you guys were doing an operation, some of your guys got surrounded. You needed help. The LAPD was slow to come. They're not supposed to help you out under these sanctuary city laws. That is one of the reasons why the president said we need National Guard. So if you're not going to let LAPD help, I'm gonna get you. I'll be your backup, right?
I mean, yeah.
Is that the scenario that took place?
Yeah. And, you know, that's what it was. When we have, you know, and prime example, the first night of the riot on January 6th, we had ICE senior officials, my friends, my level, that were in the facility visiting, that they were under siege. They themselves had to put on their tactical gear, shoot pepper balls, as, you know, high up senior ICE officials, because they were surrounded and there was no one to come to help them.
Unbelievable. So, and then you had the operation there. Now you have Operation Midway. Now you're moving into Memphis. You're going to be a key. You guys are key movers and shakers in that. While doing operations in all 50 states, it looks like the numbers you guys are have you deported 600,000?
Yep. And if you look at the number that they're saying, over 2 million have already self-deported. Because so I think
2
people,
million.
I think people realize that, you know, President Trump's given the opportunity to come back in legally and live the American dream, right?
Back in a moment, more with the acting ICE director, Todd Lyons, in lieu of the big shooting yesterday. We got to get to the bottom of this, and it's got to stop. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade.
It's the Will Cain Show. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday on FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss a show. Get the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is a governor who is saying that he does not want ICE agents to put masks on, and they're doing that for their safety because there's a threat to them and their family out there, as we saw with the shooting today and the threats that come in daily to them. But this is the same governor who forced two-year-olds to wear masks during COVID, and he wielded executive power to muzzle people. And so I think he thinks that he just has ultimate power to do this.
And he doesn't. And that's one of the best governors in the country, certainly the most effective, Ron DeSantis, talking about the idiocy of a governor of California demanding that ICE agents take off their masks. Keep in mind, the acting director, Todd Lyons, is here. You just told me that now your FBI and ATF are doing the same thing. These are federal officers. He has no say over you guys, right?
No, he doesn't have any say over
us. So what was that, theater?
I think that's all it is political theory. He's just making a statement. But again, is he going to pit California state police or local police to try to arrest federal agents for doing their job?
It would never happen.
It would never happen. But again, that's pitting us against each other. But what I would love to see is, how come he didn't put out a bill for the protesters in L.A. that are all masked, that are constantly out there causing harm and mayhem? But they can run around and do whatever they want. But ICE officers and agents that are out there doing a sworn law enforcement mission, we're the bad guys.
Right. And there's an investigation right now about what happened in Dallas, and the FBI is handling that. They're taking the lead on that. So there'll be a press conference a little bit later. But when you talk about vilifying, listen to Hillary Clinton yesterday, cut 16.
We have got to stop demonizing each other.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, I think most of that right now in our country's history is coming, you know, from the right, coming from people who want to dominate. They want their point of view. We have got to stop with the finger pointing and the scapegoating.
But it came from the right. I'll finger point, I'll scapegoat, the exact opposite. Not acknowledging Charlie Kirk, not acknowledging what happened yesterday.
No, and you, if you look at it, it's all Democratic elected officials that have called for the violence or called for the doxing or the threats my officers and agents.
So people are saying, you know what, you're going to get the worst of the worst, but you're picking up people that are just overstaying their visas, been here a long time, aren't threats. You're picking up short order cooks and farm workers. What's the reality?
You know, the reality is that we're enforcing the law the way it's written. So while we go out there and we are arresting these bad guys, these ones that are arrested or released from sanctuary cities, if we encounter somebody that might be in that car on a traffic stop or in the house when we go arrest this person, you're here illegally and you don't have a right to be here, you're going to get arrested too. You're going to be held accountable. But there's over 1.5 million people that have been lawfully ordered removed from the United States. Now, they just ignored a federal judge's order to go back to their home country. We have to find those too. We have to have a rule of law. We just can't turn a blind eye like we've done so many times.
Something else you're doing. So you capture me. I come across the border illegally. My asylum claim is going to get heard, right?
Yeah.
So for mostly, you get it, if it's Joe Biden or Barack Obama, you get a paper, come back in 6 years for your hearing. Now, what's changed?
What's changed now is we're following the law where if you do have an asylum claim, you'll be held and you'll hear it in a timely fashion to get your due process.
Within 6 months, because after 6 months, you got to let people go.
Yeah. So we do. One thing with ICE is that people think we just hold people indefinitely. We can't. There's Supreme Court decisions that we can't. But we hold people to remove them. It's not punitive.
Not to punish.
No, we don't punish. We're holding them in the country or, you know, till we get their country to take them back. But we also know, we've seen in the last administration, so many people were released. And now they're just running around the country.
Yeah.
To your point, in New York City, there were court dates out to 2037. You know, so how do you do that? How do you let somebody in 2022 right. And then, oh, you come back and see a judge in 2037?
So what you're doing now is you try to get that third country involved. You have countries that want to cooperate. We saw with El Salvador. And then you have Uganda comes to mind. Sudan seems to be open to it. So you take a guy from Venezuela, and the country says, I don't want him back. So your hands were tied. Not anymore.
Not anymore. And it's people think that this is something new. President Trump just is you know, created new law. No, this has been in the Immigration Nationality Act for decades. We always had the option to send some to a safe third country, but other administrations wouldn't allow us to do it. Now, if a violent person doesn't, you know, their country won't take them back, and we have another country that will take them, absolutely. We're going to go ahead and remove them.
So I crossed during the Biden years, and I'm living in New York City. I'm living on the free housing, getting my free food, living... So I'm here, and my desk ticket says 2032. Are you going to look to get me? So to get me, pull me out, and send me back to my country?
What we're doing is we're adding more immigration judges now. We're adding more attorneys. We want to get that backlog.
So they'll get notified. We're picking up the dates. Now it's going to be 2026.
Yeah, and these people do report into ICE offices. You hear that, they showed up for their appointment at ICE, and they were arrested. Well, yeah. I mean, you do show up, whether, you know, maybe once a month, say it was your reporting time. But if we now have a time to get you into court and see a judge, then we're going to do it. We're just not going to let you run around the U.S. free.
Have you deputized other people? Because there's only so many judges in this country.
So we're working right now to work with the Department of War to get judge advocates and try to find other ways to get more immigration judge in the system.
And the number right now, the percentage of those with criminal records that you're going for, that you have targeted and
70%.
70%. And the other 30?
The other 30 of individuals that have been either ordered deported previously, mm-hmm. we're going to go ahead and execute those final orders, or people that we've encountered on the street when we do our operations.
It's called enforcement. And don't tell me you support the police and don't support ICE. You can't separate the two. Todd Lyons, thanks for everything you're doing. I thoroughly appreciate it. You're making the country a better place. Ambassador Oren next. Thanks, Mr. Director.
Thanks, Brian.
Back.
This episode is brought to you by LifeLock. When you visit the doctor, you probably hand over your insurance, your ID, and contact details. It's just one of the many places that has your personal info. And if any of them accidentally expose it, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/podcast. Terms apply.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
All right, we are back. Ambassador Michael Oren joins us now, former Israeli ambassador to the United States. And we're also talking about what's happening at the UN. Ambassador, we have France, we have the UK, we have Australia, Canada, and other nations recognizing a Palestinian state. What changes now?
In fact, nothing, but also everything, Brian. Good morning. Good to be with you. This is a measure that is pro forma, okay? France, Great Britain, Australia, Canada recognize the existence of a Palestinian state. They join about 135 other countries who over the course of the last decade have recognized a Palestinian state. Do you see any Palestinian state out there? I don't. So nothing has happened. But what does happen? First of all, the move is anti-Israel. It's anti-Palestinian. It's also anti-American. It's very important to understand that this is anti. It's a slap in the face of the president of the United States. It's anti-Israel because these countries have recognized a Palestinian state that does not accept the existence of a Jewish state, doesn't accept the existence of a Jewish people, which regards all of Jewish history, including the temple in which Jesus taught, as a fiction. It's a Palestinian state that teaches its own kids to kill Jews, to murder Jews. It pays murderers of Jews in Israeli prisons. This is the state they recognize. Thoroughly corrupt, does not even control its own party, its own territory. Mahmoud Abbas, the presumptive head of the state, is in the 21st year of his four-year term in office. So there you have the state they just recognized. That's anti-Israel, and it'll be used against us in international courts to try to put boycotts and sanctions against us. It's anti-Palestinian because who cheered this decision but Hamas? And every time Hamas gets this tremendous concession as a reward for terror, it simply walks away from a negotiating table. So the war in Gaza goes on and more Palestinians get killed. It's actually anti-Palestinian. It's anti-American because the United States has signed on an agreement, the 1993 Oslo Accord, signed by Bill Clinton, a Democratic president, who said that the Palestinians in that agreement said the Palestinians must not declare a state unilaterally. So basically, all these presumptive allies of the United States.
And I think wasn't part of that
violation
deal.
Violation of American policy.
Wasn't part of that deal they were going to get most of the West Bank, all of Gaza, and there was going to be some type of bridge to both lands, and they were going to get even a portion of Jerusalem, and Yasser Arafat walked away from that? Is that true?
Palestinians hold the world record, Brian, for a people who walks away from the two-state solution most frequently. They did it well before that. They did it in 1937, 1947, when the UN partitioned Palestine into a Jewish and Arab state. And then, yes, in 2000, 2001, and again in 2008, they were offered a West Bank state, almost the entire West Bank, half of Jerusalem. We were going to redivide our capital. And yes, a tunnel to Gaza was going to be a Palestinian state. First Yasser Arafat and then Mahmoud Abbas, his successor, walked away from those deals.
So I think it's important to point out the origin of this. So when Britons control the area and in the 30s, when they decide to divide it up and Israel becomes a state, the Palestinians who were just created, I thought, came out of nowhere. There wasn't really no Palestinians, correct?
Well, there's no Palestine. Palestine was an area. It's like saying they're Appalachians.
Okay? Yeah.
So they're Rocky Mountainers. It was an area of the Middle East.
So was it the Balfour Declaration that divided it? And the Palestinians, whatever you want to call them, said, no, 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 I want it all. And if you don't give us it all, we're leaving. And they left. And now they want their stuff back with their right of return. No, no, you left. A country was established. You were attacked in 48, attacked in 67, attacked in 73. And then we know what happened in 79, and then we know what happened 1981, I think, another conflict, and then the conflict you're currently in. But the Palestinians had what the UN gave them, but they refused to take it. Now they want it.
It wasn't just that they left. They fought to destroy it. In 1937, this is ancient history, the British proposed dividing Palestine into a Jewish and Arab state. The Arabs rejected it and then went to war against the Jewish state. In 1947, the UN created these two states, and the Palestinians and other Arab countries went to war to destroy that state. It wasn't as if they just picked up and left.
1 year later.
They actually acted. So in 2000, okay, with Bill Clinton and Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat, they made that offer to Arafat. Like almost the entire West Bank, half of Jerusalem, Gaza. Arafat didn't just walk away. They launched a second intifada to destroy the Jewish state. And it happens again and again and again. So it's not passive. It's very, very active. And we have to understand this. This is a crucial, crucial fact.
One of the people that is most fervent in backing your story and is still bitter is Bill Clinton, because he basically put his whole presidency, spending all this time with Yasser Arafat, and he walked away from the deal that he told me he was going to take. And he said, well, if I take it, they're going to kill me. And great. So now we're dealing with the turbulence today. So here's Emmanuel Macron. This is his rationalization for, by the way, hurting hostage negotiations in making this announcement. And Hamas feels as though, why give up now? We're beginning to win over the West. Cut 46.
And just perhaps to make it clear on that, I think it's why yesterday 11 countries did recognize Palestine? It was not a decision taken like that, neither by UK, nor by Canada, nor by France. It's just a big change. Nobody, President Trump is totally right. Nobody forgets the 7th of October. I went there a few days after, taking families in my hands, and it's, we experienced all together these horrific attacks. And by the way, we lost a lot of French people in these terrorist attacks. But after almost 2 years of war, what is the result? Once again, they killed the top leaders of Hamas.
So I could pick that apart, but I'd like you to.
you might give me a shovel and a pickaxe on that. Let me get this straight. The Hamas launches its murderous attack on October 7th, kills 1,200 Israelis in the most horrendous way, takes 251 hostages. And there's been a war for 2 years, and Hamas leaders have been killed. So we should just call it quits and let Hamas win and let it take over the Gaza Strip again, because that's exactly what happens if Hamas wins. They reorganize, they rearm. They launch the next October 7th, because that's precisely what their leaders say. They say they're going to do it 10,000 times until Israel is destroyed. And by the way, Brian, Hamas is not going to give back all the hostages because they're evil, but they're not stupid. And they know the minute they give back the last hostages, we go back and we killed them. So there you have it. That's his answer to October 7th. And maybe we're lost in translation, but it makes absolutely no sense to me.
I mean, it's laziness. It's like, well, we don't like Hamas, but we want to recognize a Palestinian state. Well, what does this state look like? And who's running it? The Palestinian Authority? The Palestinian Authority has no credibility. One of the richest people in the region is Mahmoud Abbas, because he's taken all the aid money and made himself rich. He's totally ineffective. He got kicked out of Gaza by Hamas. And they say there's no Hamas presence in the West Bank. That is not true.
Well, that's absolutely not true. Tell that to the Israelis who have been killed in recent weeks by Hamas in the West Bank, including 6 civilians killed in Jerusalem. Just over 2 weeks ago, and Hamas, you know, gleefully took responsibility for that. Of course, there's Hamas in the West Bank. Exactly. Everyone will, the people who are in favor of the two-state solution will say that everybody knows what it looks like. I've been involved in the peace process for over 30 years. I started off as an advisor to Yitzhak Rabin in the early 90s. And I will tell you that nobody knows what this looks like. No one knows the borders. No one knows who will lead it. As you say, will it be a democratic state? Will it be an Islamic state? Will be a corrupt state under Mahmoud Abbas, will be a state that actually makes peace. And the big sticking point in every round of negotiations, and I was in the last round of negotiations with the Palestinians, and I'll tell you this firsthand, there has never been one Palestinian leader, not one in history, who will accept the existence of a Jewish people,
yes.
A Jewish people with a real tie to this land. As I said earlier, they don't recognize the existence of a second temple, a first temple where Jesus taught. All that archaeological evidence is all fabricated. And they will never put what they call an end to the claims, an end to the conflict. They view a two-state solution as a temporary solution until Israel is wiped off the map.
So the president, evidently behind closed doors, meeting with Arab leaders, said, I guarantee you, I will not allow Israel to annex the West Bank. Are you looking to annex? Are they looking to annex the West Bank? And are you okay with that? What the president said.
The West Bank is a large area. I think that there are significant support in Israel for annexing the Jordan Valley. Now, the Jordan Valley separates Israel from Jordan. It's down where you find Jericho, where the Jordan River is. And that is the area that Israel may need for security reasons to prevent smuggling from Jordan, actually through Iran, through Jordan, into the West Bank. I'm sure Israeli leaders are mulling this, even leaders on the center and the left. Benny Gantz, one of the leaders of the center-leftist opposition to Israel, yesterday in the New York Times published an op-ed calling for Israel to annex the Jordan Valley.
So I understand with the operation in Gaza City, this could take months, even though it's not the biggest city in the world, but it's dense with buildings and now rubble. Do you believe Gaza City, to take down Hamas once and for all, will do it when it's done, or are they going to just squirt out of there to go somewhere else?
Well, there's two answers to this. You know, people will say, wow, the mighty Israeli army can't defeat a bunch of terrorists in one city in the West Bank. Let's keep in mind, this is exactly the same army that defeated Hezbollah, which was considered not just one of the most powerful armies in the Middle East, but in the world. It's a army that humbled Iran, mighty Iran, a country 10 times the size of Israel. There's only two reasons why Israel cannot conquer Gaza City in an afternoon, and that is because of the civilian population there and because, of course, of the hostages. Otherwise, the Israeli army could just move in. In 1967 war, Israel took Gaza in about a day and a half. So it's because of the civilians, because of the hostages. It will take months. I have been urging in my writing in the Israeli press that we move very quickly. I don't think that President Trump has that much patience. I think he wants to see an end to the war, and I agree with that. And he wants to see the opening of peace negotiations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. And that can't happen as long as they're fighting in Gaza. So we would hope that the Israeli army would move very quickly. Once it does, once Gaza City falls into Israeli hands, it's going to be a process. It's a process of rooting out the remnants of Hamas. It's negotiating with the terrorists who are holding our hostages to release those hostages. And then we begin a very deep process. And I hope I have time to say this, and that is the world seems to believe, Brian, that Hamas landed in Gaza out of Mars, that somehow there was no connection between the population of Gaza and Hamas. But what we know is that this is a long process. These are people who have been educated since before they could walk, that the most sacred thing they can do is kill an Israeli. And we have to denazify them, literally denazify them. We have to create a different education system for the people of Gaza so that they will think about peace and not about jihad.
Going to be tough to re-educate a people. You know, in 20 years, we began to see some progress in Afghanistan. And then we foolishly left. And now all that thinking came back. But is there an Arab, the day after in Gaza, is there an international Arab presence that you might want to deal with? Have you guys, can you tell our audience anything about what it will look like when the shooting stops?
I think when the shooting stops, to the degree that it will stop, there may still always be pockets. Okay? There's always going to be terrorism in our area of the world. And listen, it's in the West as well. We get an inter-Arab force there. Certainly we're considering it. And that international force will supervise not only security in Gaza, but also the reconstruction of Gaza, effective way, and also the re-education of Gaza. Now, the Saudis have embarked on re-educating their young people. They used to educate the young people in a very different way, to hate the West. And we saw the outcome of that back in 9/11. The Saudis have changed their entire education system to talk about peace, to talk about acceptance and tolerance. It can be done. It can be done. So it has to be at the grassroots level. It's not just people patrolling streets. It's teachers in the classroom and different textbooks, which is actually going to be crucial. And of course, Israel will cooperate this, and Israel will lend its security prowess and its means to help achieve that goal.
Iran's president yesterday says they have no interest in a nuclear weapon. Are they making moves to reconstruct their nuclear program?
It seems they're making moves to reconstruct their missile capabilities. And this is a discussion we have to have.
They tested one yesterday, didn't they? Or the day before?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they're also providing very advanced missile capabilities to the Houthi rebels, who have been shooting at us, both drones and missiles, including cluster bombs. These are long-range ballistic missiles with cluster bomb heads. These are heads that break up into many different bombs. So that's from Iran. Houthis have no ability to create these themselves. So, yes, and that's the answer. So it's an intimate discussion we have to have with our American allies in the White House. At what point? What's the red line here? At what point does the United States and Israel agree that Iran has violated the ceasefire? And what will the United States and Israel do?
Are you recognizing a Lebanese government? Do they have legitimate power, or do they have more power than Hezbollah now? Or what's left of Hezbollah?
Hezbollah is still a formidable force. There we won a strategic victory, not just a military victory. A strategic victory is that Hezbollah is not threatening us anymore, but they still have many, many thousands of rockets. They still have many, many thousands of terrorists under arms. And the Lebanese government is very legitimate, and we'd like to make peace with that government. But that Lebanese government has to disarm Hamas, which is not going to be easy. Remember, I said earlier, even before this war, Hezbollah was one of the most formidable militaries, not just
gold
the
standard,
Middle East, but
gold standard. They were the best.
It was 100,000 rebels, guerrillas, terrorists under arms, but about 200,000 rockets, including very long-range rockets, very accurate rockets. Not many armies in the world have that. And so we have defeated them militarily. Now the big question is, can the Lebanese government demilitarize Hezbollah and reclaim control?
Not themselves. They're going to need help.
Well, they're getting help. They're getting help from the United States, but they need more. Imagine how much arms you have to give to the Lebanese army so it can begin to equal Hezbollah. and then it has to take on Hezbollah.
And they got to make sure those arms don't end up in Hezbollah's hands, because you don't know how loyal the Lebanese army is. The Syrian president, so far he's saying the right things. Your feeling about
my feeling is
the
he's
former
saying
Al-Qaeda
the right things.
Terrorists?
And he's a former Shara, is a former member of Al-Qaeda. It's true. He claims he wants to bring about a different Syria. Okay, let's explore it. Certainly let's explore it. Let's begin by talking about our border issues, because we do have border issues. And let him prove it. Syria is a very unstable country. It's a country that was cobbled together by the French from many different ethnicities and religious groups. We've seen now how the same government of al-Shara, which pledges peace, has turned around and massacred its own Alawite citizens and its own Druze citizens. Massacred in a ways that very much resembled October 7th. And okay, let him prove that Syria is different, and let him prove that he can survive, Syria is held together traditionally, historically, by brute and central force. That's what the Assads did. Let's see if he has it. Let's see if he's alive in another year.
At least the mostly Sunni country, they were controlled by a Shia Alawite section. So maybe the majority would rule there. I don't know. I guess they're diverse.
Know.
Yeah. Ambassador, complicated area. You're so close to getting to peace in the region because of the effective military operations that almost everybody told you not to do. Ambassador Michael.
And because of the support we get from
yes,
the White House.
Absolutely.
We cannot overlook that.
With this president. Ambassador Michael Oren, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, this is Dave Anthony. Today on the Fox News Rundown podcast, a reaction to another rooftop shooting in another case of political violence, this time targeting immigration agents. We talked to former Congressman Trey Gowdy. Go to foxnewspodcast.com to listen and follow.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I did hear from one very special friend. Moments after we taped our show last night, the Mad Red Hatter wrote, "I can't believe ABC Fake News gave Jimmy Kimmel his job back." You can't believe they gave me my job back. I can't believe we gave you your job back.
Right. So it just continues to be. I mean, do you see the numbers in terms of he's had one Republican guest on? It was Mike Lindell, and he just mocked him. And did you see the 97% of his monologue is anti-Trump?
I didn't see those numbers, but it doesn't surprise me at all.
And Colbert's got basically the same stats. So I'm not saying take him off the air, but it is a DNC. It is like a DNC channel with some actors on, you know, and some there's no even skits. So that's what the president's talking about. You know, should they be banned? No, but to me, if you want to double your audience, have other guests.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. This hour, we're going to talk to Josh Holmes of the Ruthless Podcast, former chief of staff to Senator Mitch McConnell. We'll get into the shutdown. He's been through almost all of this before and, of course, doing a great job on Ruthless with the podcast they put together during the pandemic that Fox just purchased. So there's here. So Josh is going to be with us. Mark Thiessen is standing by. But Mark Thiessen is dealing with Uber Eats has not arrived. And he says, I'm not coming on the air until it arrives. So I'm going to buy some time with the big three.
Number three.
By the way, another piece of what is unprecedented and a bit historical about that race, it is the closest presidential mm-hmm. race in the 21st century
yeah.
in terms of the outcome.
It's just not true. I mean, what the hell? And nobody says anything. Nobody says anything. They just go, oh, okay, sounds good to me. Kamala's book tour reminds us daily how lucky we are that she lost, as she struggles to communicate her own story, written in her own book, while alienating her own party and former boss.
Number two.
Well, it certainly is a switch from the position that President Trump earlier took with regard to Ukraine's prospects in the war with Russia. You'll recall he's changed his tune completely, and now he says not only that they can win the war and drive Russia out of the territory it has conquered since the invasion.
I love it. Brit Hume surprised by it. Trump kicks Putin to the curb and goes all in for Ukraine. How this could actually save the West. But does he risk splitting his party?
Number one.
Masked men jumping out of unmarked cars, people disappearing, no due process. No oversight, zero accountability happening in the United States of America today. People ask, well, is authoritarianism, you're being hyperbolic? Bull, we're being hyperbolic.
What an actor and what a joke. ICE under attack. More shootings, more protests, and more irresponsible Democratic fear-mongering on the agents that have them in severe danger while they try to take the dangerous criminals and illegal criminals off the streets. Case in point, the attack in Dallas on Wednesday. I'm not one to say, well, because you said this, he shot him. But I'm telling you, Governor Pritzker, Governor Newsom, Governor Waltz, the mayors of and the attorney generals in Philadelphia, all these Democratic areas making ICE the bad guys because they cover their face for their own security. And now we find out ATF is going to have to do the same thing because they are getting doxxed. Mark Thiessen joins us now. Mark, I finished the show yesterday, and we're dealing with the Dallas shooting. You have a guy just spraying the ICE facility randomly with guns, took his own life. How you have to be able to tie that rhetoric to those twisted actions.
Absolutely. Look, it's giving license to lunatics and radicals to commit acts of murder. I mean, you know, there was a poll came out, a YouGov poll, that shows that the number of conservatives who say that violence is acceptable for political means, it's like, I think 88% say never, under no circumstances is it acceptable. Among the left, it's, you know, between 65 and 55, depending on whether you're far left or left. So, I mean, that means a sizable minority of Democrats think that it's okay to use political violence to achieve political ends. And the people who say they don't support that are the ones who are giving them license to do it with their rhetoric. When Joe Biden says that Trump supporters are garbage and that Republicans want Jim Crow 2.0, and when Kamala Harris says that Republicans are fascists and that Trump's going to round up his political opponents using the military, what you're saying is, and quite frankly, when they start, you know, saying that ICE agents are like the Gestapo running around like rounding up people, what you're saying is not that your opponents are wrong and we disagree with their policy. You're saying they're evil, and when people are evil, that gives license to take matters into your own hands. You know, so I think that responsible people on the left need to really take a deep look in the mirror and stop using this dehumanizing, over-the-top rhetoric that, you know, is telling their people, you know, the enemy is evil. We need to stop them.
Yeah, here's J.D. Vance yesterday speaking from the heart. Cut 7.
You don't have to agree with my immigration policies. You don't have to agree with Donald Trump's immigration policies. But if your political rhetoric encourages violence against our law enforcement, you can go straight to hell and you have no place in the political conversation of the United States of America.
And tell me if this is incendiary. Cut 5.
Donald Trump's modern-day Gestapo is scooping folks up off the streets.
We are not used to our government censoring, chilling speech, disappearing people.
This is Gestapo-like behavior, where plainclothes officers wearing masks are terrorizing immigrants.
Yeah, to where I'm at. Illegal immigrant criminals, 70% of which have criminal records, some of which we don't take it from Cuba and Venezuela, don't subscribe to the international criminal investigation system. So this is unbelievably irresponsible. I can't remember something equally irresponsible.
You know what the amazing thing is, too? I mean, you just heard that from their own words, Gestapo. So what do you do with the Gestapo? What did we do? What was our national policy? We went to war with them. We killed them, right? So, you know, you Great can't point. Go around calling people Nazis. It's deeply irresponsible. I just find it absolutely appalling.
President's changed his policies on Ukraine. I hope it sticks. He's coming out saying not only is Russia economically on their last legs, they're a paper tiger, and they've done horrible in this war, and Ukraine can get their land back. Listen to Zelensky speaking with a bounce in his step yesterday at the United Nations. Cut 18.
If we will have such long-distance weapon from the United States, we will use it. Against Moscow, we are not terrorists. Even our people for today they hate Russians because they began the war and they killed us. But all our people understand that we don't need to attack civilians.
And they attacked the prime minister's office.
Yeah, they attacked.
So if what would you tell somebody who works at the Kremlin today? Would you tell him to make sure he knows where the nearest bomb shelter is?
First of all, they have to know where their bomb shelters are. If they will not stop the war, they will need it in any case.
So Zelensky says his country wants peace, but it has to have weapons. Weapons decide who survives. And they think they have a plan to continue to bomb up the energy sector. And if they can get permission to do the long-distance rockets into Moscow, they will. I think the president's looking to do that.
I think he is, too. I mean, look, think Putin has terribly miscalculated here. So Donald Trump gave Putin every chance in the world to show that he was interested in peace. And Putin's biggest mistake was accepting the invitation to the Alaska summit. Because what Trump did was he rolled out the red carpet for him. He gave him the prestige of a summit meeting with the president of the United States on U.S. soil. And the implicit understanding from that was, if you accept that invitation, you're accepting the whole package, which is now you meet with Zelensky, now you meet, we have the tripartite meeting, we're trying to negotiate a peace deal. And what Putin did was he pocketed the prestige of the meeting and then broke the deal and refused to meet with Zelensky. And not only did he refuse to meet with Zelensky, he increased his bombings. His escalation. Trump hands Putin a letter from his wife saying, for the sake of the children, let's negotiate peace. And his response to that was to bomb a kindergarten. That's a slap in the face to the first lady. And then he bombs the Ukrainian cabinet of ministers effort in a decapitation strike. Then he sends drones into Poland and Romania. Then he sends a fighter jet over the border into Estonia. These are all insults to Donald Trump. And Trump is correct in saying that the reason why Russia invaded Ukraine is because Joe Biden is weak. Well, now Putin has been testing Trump's resolve. And he's going to find that Donald Trump is not Sleepy Joe. You don't do that to Donald Trump, who just gave you the red carpet in Alaska. You don't slap him in the face that way. And I think Putin's going to find that the counterpunch is a lot harder than anything he's delivered.
So Yermak, I think their foreign minister, and Zelensky himself stated Tuesday that Trump is coming to realize that Putin's claims of total superiority on the battlefield are fairy tale. And they showed him proof of it evidently behind closed doors in their meeting. And that's what General Kellogg and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff have been telling the president, that Ukraine is doing a lot better. And think about it, 4 years in with the army, four times the size, maybe more, they could not take Kyiv. They've taken 19% of their country and moved 1% after their summer offensive. While their economy teeters with double-digit inflation, and now they're going to be raising their VAT tax on a population that already is paying more for oil and gas and are dealing with shortages because they've been bombing the refineries. So look, obviously, they have more people in Russia, but they need to know that if you're going to continue to fight this war, there's a plan for them to lose it.
Absolutely. I mean, look, think, and by the way, they control 19% of Ukraine. They controlled 14% before the 2022 invasion. They already had Crimea and parts of Donbass and Zaporizhia. So, you know, they've gained, you know, probably, you know, what, like, you know, 9% or 8% or some small fraction over 3 years at a cost of a million casualties. So I mean, Trump is right. They are a paper tiger or a paper bear, whatever the hell you want to call it. If the U.S. the reason why Ukraine has not been able to drive the Russians out is because Joe Biden tied one hand behind their back for 4 years. He didn't want Ukraine to win. He just wanted to stop Russia from winning. And he didn't have a strategy for victory. So he didn't let them use it. He slow rolled the weapons. He restrained them from using them on Russian territory. If Trump takes off the gloves off of Ukraine and gives them weapons, and by the way, selling them, not so taxpayers aren't paying for it anymore. We're actually making a profit and strengthening our defense industrial base, and lets them use those against Russian targets. Russia's going to be on its heels very, very quickly.
Russia, 750,000, according to ISW, 750,000 casualties, 250,000 deaths. So that's, put them together, it's over a million. Ukraine's lost 60,000 and 100,000 casualties. So they're fighting off an invasion. And they're better fighters. And I thought it was brought up to me by an acting general right now. He said to me, for the American people to think that this is, doesn't involve them, would they want to know that the biggest army in Europe has been taken over, taken the second biggest army in Europe and made them allies? If we lose Ukraine, we'll lose the finest pound-for-pound fighting force and the biggest army. Why would you do that? Who has cutting-edge technology when it comes to this drone capabilities? I want you to hear Zelensky's warning yesterday. Cut 20.
We are now living through the most destructive arms race in human history, because this time includes artificial intelligence. We need global rules now for how AI can be used in weapons, and this is just as urgent as preventing the spread of nuclear weapons. We need to restore international cooperation, real working cooperation, for peace and for security. A few years from now might already be too late.
Because he's saying that drones, get this, will act without any human design or launch. They will do it on their own.
Yeah, the arms control wasn't the solution during the Cold War. It's not just a solution during the Second Cold War. You know, the reality is there's no country in the world that is more technologically advanced than the United States. We can win an AI arms race. And the idea that we're going to have some international, string stopping China and Russia and other countries from trying to use AI in their weapons, all we would do is restrict ourselves.
Okay,
I think Zelensky should focus on winning the war in his country and not international arms control for AI.
Bring you into politics and international relations. You know, there's a group of Republicans who want nothing to do with this Ukraine war. That's why they stopped the funding, but they didn't agree with the tactics. They didn't agree with it. And Trump is one of them. So Trump, obviously, I take him at his word. He's changed as he looked at what Putin's done and he's looked at what Ukraine has accomplished. Now, the vice president has never been on board with this. So listen to what he said yesterday from Concord, North Carolina, cut 19.
I believe the president is growing incredibly impatient with the Russians right now because he doesn't feel like they're putting enough on the table to end the war. If the Russians refuse to negotiate in good faith, I think it's going to be very, very bad for their country. That's what the president made clear. It's not a shift in position. It's an acknowledgement of the reality on the ground. We're going to keep on fighting for peace every single day in the Trump administration.
Read between the lines. What do you think?
So, first of all, I agree that it's not a change in position on Trump. What Trump has said from the beginning is that he wanted to give Putin a chance to negotiate peace, but that if he didn't, he said this during the campaign, he said it 2 years before the election, that if Putin doesn't agree to peace, he's going to crush his economy and he's going to increase weapons to Ukraine. So he's been on record as this from the very beginning. This is not just – people saying this is a shift, a pivot or something like that. No. What's happened is that Putin has made absolutely clear that he is not interested in peace. And Trump is seeing that now. And so he's going back to the policy that he articulated years ago, which is we're going to arm the Ukrainians and we're going to crush the Russian economy and force Putin's going to have to be coerced to come into the peace table. He's not going to do it willingly. So I don't think there's any shift in position at all right now. And Trump has never been one of the Republican first of all, he's not an isolationist. I know there's an isolationist segment on the right. He's never been one of those. This is the guy who just blew up, obliterated the Iranian nuclear program. The guy who killed Qasem Soleimani. The guy who launched a cyber attack in his first term on the Russian Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg. He's not an isolationist. He's never been one. And everybody who keeps saying, and by the way, all the polls show, you look at the Reagan Institute poll, MAGA voters are not isolationist either.
I don't think so. Yeah,
So Trump has the backing of his people. He's got the right policy, and the GOP isolationists are a tiny but vocal faction that don't represent the MAGA movement.
And I just hope JD is not a charter member. or if he was, I hope he took his membership back.
He's the apprentice right now. I hope so. He's learning.
He's been very loyal. So there's no doubt about it. There's no murmur behind the scenes that Donald Trump has the wrong policy. So that's one thing is clear. We would have heard that. So Mark Thiessen, fascinating time. I always feel good when the president reads your columns or talks to you. I think it's good for our foreign policy. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Back in a moment.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I just don't like the whole numbers. I really liked that you could tell, just as like a fan, I really liked by like even like watching a jersey, looking at a jersey.
I want a quarterback to wear 99.
See, I don't want that. I liked looking at a jersey and knowing without even knowing the guy what position that guy played. There was something about the numbers signifying what position you played and that I just liked. I don't know. I just was a fan of it. I don't like that now the numbers mean nothing on defense. Anybody can wear whatever the they want. And then on offense, you still have ineligible numbers.
I agree. I 100% agree. You used to know if somebody in their 50, if you see a guy in his 50s, the number 50 on his jersey, it's a linebacker. Wow, what a great play. He came from the other side as a linebacker. Or a linebacker's up at the line. Is he a stand-up defensive end? I'm not sure. Let's say if you know your team, you know your team. But a Brian Burns is great lineman, right, who's also sometimes the linebacker. It's number zero. What does that mean? It used to be field goal kickers, you know. So I am all for that. I have no idea why we loosened up the numbers. I want to know what a wide receiver should be in their 80s, right? The offensive lineman should be in their 60s. That's the way it should be. The 70s should be defensive lineman. Then you can go, wow, that guy's a nose tackle. I get it. But if he makes a great tackle by the end zone, you go, wow, what great hustler. It made it a lot easier. And if Jason Kelsey says it, I believe it.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
The current sitting president is running for re-election. 3.5 months from the election, he decides not to run. The sitting vice president then takes the mantle, running against a former president of the United States who had been running for 10 years with 107 days until the election. And by the way, another piece of what is unprecedented and a bit historical about that race, it is the closest presidential race in the 21st century in terms of the outcome.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. You know, say that again, because he likes to say over and over again he's got a mandate.
And that's part of why I wrote this book, because history will talk about this race. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is part of American history. And it was important to me that when history is written, that my voice be present.
Okay. There is so much wrong about what she said. First and foremost, it was the closest race in the 21st century. What are you talking about? Anybody who can do math and these idiots who go to The View and clap for that instead of saying, excuse me, I remember the hanging Chad. I remember Bush Gore that needed a month to count the ballots. Remember how close? There's been very close. That was not a close election. And let alone saying that she was up against it. You had 107 days. You didn't have to go through the primary process. You had over $1 billion. And he went from an 11-point deficit to Biden to a 3-point lead in September. You blew a 3-point lead because people got to know you. You didn't run out of time. You had 107 days, was actually too much time. Maybe Josh Holmes totally disagrees, and he feels bad because it's my show disagreeing. We're about to find out. He's with the Ruthless Podcast. He's chief of staff for Senator Mitch McConnell, president and founding partner of Cavalry LLC. Josh, you vehemently disagree with me.
Kill me. He just nailed it. I mean, first of all, I totally appreciate the Yas Queen response from the ladies at The View to just absolute abject nonsense coming out of Kamala Harris's mouth. You're totally right. 107 days was about 75 days too long. Once everybody got a load of what she had to say and saw her clear, unqualified everything about her and her campaign, she took a nosedive in the poll. I mean, the first 10 days worked out pretty well for her. Everything after that, disaster.
But she's not a great candidate, and she has trouble telling her own story. You know, she was telling the Josh Holmes story, which has yet to be told, I wouldn't mind. I could see that she's been hesitant. But Josh, the books that she wrote, the stories that she lived just a year ago, I'm not asking her to remember 1971, right? Just a year ago, she struggles to get words out smoothly. And the stuff that she says is crazy. And I think this is where I might differ with you. I think this is sets her up for 28, even though it's going to fail. I don't think she's going anywhere. People think this is her epitaph. I don't. I think that she has nowhere to go. She's going to she's going to do this.
I mean, you're right in that. What else is she going to do, Brian? What else is she going to do? And politicians like this that make it to the stage that she has, mind you, she was within an.
Oh, we just lost him. We're going to pop back up because Josh lives his life on a stream. The Ruthless Podcast is on a stream. So, and in fact, I was lucky enough to do the show in Washington, D.C. And if you're on a stream, you know they can be somewhat temperamental. So he's going to pop back in there. But I do want to let it be clear that I guess we do agree on this. I was on the panel on Special Report, and everyone thinks, including Harold Ford, that she's done, she's finished, she's through. Well, I don't know. I think that she says by brushing back Shapiro, by calling out Waltz being inadequate, by saying Newsom was taking a hike, literally taking a hike rather than helping, by saying that Joe Biden really hurt her at the end and was selfish. So she's telling everybody, I'm making distance to from my future opponents. You know, the next shoe to drop is going to be the leaks from Jill Biden's camp and others. What a terrible running mate she was. She also writes in her book that she had to win over the trust of everyone on the Biden camp, the president's camp, the White House, because of a line she used in a debate in 2019 when she said, I was that girl in the busing, which is crazy because you had George H.W. Bush, who said about Ronald Reagan, it's voodoo economics. John Edwards was tearing up John Kerry, ends up being running mates. That's what happens all the time. And for Joe Biden's camp not to get over, and the guy's 100 years old, is crazy. It shows a lack of understanding or a very thin skin in a time in which skin shouldn't be thin. So we'll look to get it back. I don't know if we're going to try to get him back. All right, we're working on it. Let's change gears a little bit and talk about the possible Virginia race tightening up. And here's why. This Abigail Spanberger may be a better. Okay, Josh is with me. Hey, Josh, just final thought. I know we're on the phone now. We're not going to try the technological advances of streaming. I think it's going to be years before we get this down. I think it's going to be Elon Musk is going to have to tackle this directly. So, Josh, for her, I just do think there's another page in her book.
Yeah, I mean, there is another page in her book.
It's not going to be good.
No, it's just not going to be good. I think we've seen all the tools she has in the toolbox, and frankly, it's unimpressive. I mean, she doesn't have the capability of having any sort of vision. At no point did she talk about what she was going to do to improve the lives of Americans. All she could do is critique her opponent. And I think once people got to see that there was no candor whatsoever, and she wasn't going to do anything different than Joe Biden, because frankly, she has no idea what to do, it was over. And I just don't think that's ever going to change.
All right, so let's flash gears. I just want to talk about what's happening in Virginia. We got two races that both sides. Remember, Glenn Youngkin gave Republicans great momentum when they shocked everybody and won the Virginia election. He can only have one term. So as Lieutenant Governor Winsom Sears is running, she's trailing about 8. But suddenly this race is about gender again. And Spanberger's background on gender is very similar to, and they have an issue, too, in Virginia. It's very similar to Kamala Harris's, right? Be tolerant. So she's trying to talk her way out of the fact that she really believes that trans men belong in girls' locker rooms and this big uproar. So listen to her, cut 36, as she tries to talk her way out of this.
So if a bill landed on your desk and it had to do with restrooms or sports in this situation, I mean, would you support a bill that allowed this if it landed on your desk?
I would support a bill that would put clear provisions in place that provide a lot of local ability for input based on the age of children, based on the type of sport, based on competitiveness, because certainly I absolutely recognize I'm the mom of three daughters in Virginia public schools. I recognize the concern that families and community members might have about the safety of their own kids, about competitiveness, about fairness. And I think that what the process that was in place for 10 years was one that was working. It was one that, you know, took individual circumstances and individual communities into account. And
wait,
I think that
Josh,
that is the process.
I can't hear it anymore. Josh, this is absolutely talking in a circle. The process in place allowed trans boys to go into girl locker rooms, and she does not want to say it.
No, that's the best politician answer ever. It's like garble, 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 local input, read my bio, hope you forgot what the question was. I mean, you know exactly what she wants to do. She doesn't want to take a stand on this, but she knows where voters are. And this has been a troubling issue for Democrats, even in the bluest state. Like, look, I'm not going to lie and say Virginia is not a very challenging state, particularly in an off year where your turnout could be subjected to, you know, the Northern Virginia suburbs, which turn out at a huge number, which is challenging for Republicans. All that being said, they're having the conversation they don't want to have if you're a Democrat.
She doesn't want it, but Winsom Sears needs it. She needs something to catapult it. She needs Youngkin to drag her across there, and she does not have Trump's endorsement. Now, in New Jersey, this candidate, we're looking at Micah. Her last name is eluding me. Mikey Sherrill. This woman is the worst. She had, when asked, and this ad's running, when asked about what her agenda is going to be, she said she had no idea what she would do if she was governor today. And then she's asked about $7 million that she earned investing in stocks while in the House. She says, I don't really know. That's her answer. Now, Jack Chitterley lost by three last time against a sitting governor. It's about a 7-point spread. You know that New Jersey was trending towards Trump in a way that not many people thought possible. With that train wreck of a state with all the potential that it has, what do you see here?
So New Jersey is really interesting to me, Brian. It's one of those states, as you mentioned, that has trended more Republican. It certainly got more Republican in the Trump years. That message has resonated more deeply than the Republican message of the past, and we have gotten darn close. It's tough to not feel snake bitten by New Jersey because, you know, over the last 20 years, every time other than Chris Christie you get close, it just kind of never can close the door on it. But I'm really interested this time around because, as you said, Mikey Sherrill, terrible candidate. The state needs some competent leadership. I think this might be the time. That's the one that I'm really closely watching here in a few weeks.
And that will stop Democrats from saying we got great momentum going into the midterms. We'll see what happens. I want to bring you to another area, and that's the vilification of ICE that we see taking place. I can't believe after we got through defund the police, I thought we'd never go there again. But law enforcement under attack. Listen to some of the things that they've been saying about ICE and leading, in my view, directly to the shootings and incidents. One we saw in Chicago last weekend when ICE agents got surrounded. And then we see a sniper shoot into an ICE building yesterday in Dallas. Listen to some of this rhetoric. Cut five.
Donald Trump's modern-day Gestapo is scooping folks up off the streets.
We are not used to our government censoring, chilling speech, disappearing people.
This is Gestapo-like behavior, where plainclothes officers wearing masks are terrorizing immigrants.
This is stuff that it's not stopping. We watched Pritzker and Newsom, watched Newsom on Colbert's couch yesterday, and then we watched this shooting. Is there going to be any pullback at all?
You know, it's just so depressing, Brian. And here's the thing. It's hard for well-adjusted human beings to listen to any of that and do anything other than just sort of shake your head. You got to remember, these people, all these people, as crazy as it is, have a significant constituency that listens to them, that listens to their anxiety and reacts accordingly. And they're broadcasting this all to millions and millions of people who have voted for them. So if you're one of these people just sort of listening to Gavin Newsom or J.B. Pritzker or all these psychopaths who are absolutely putting ICE in a dangerous position, you think that you're on the brink of civil war. And you can also understand where the least mentally competent, the disturbed amongst us, might think they need to take action on that. This is not a far leap to suggest that they have created, not only created this problem, but incentivized crazy people to do a bunch of crazy things. It is dangerous. It needs to stop. But there is just a total failure within the Democratic Party to do anything because they're scared of their base. They're scared of the base. They said it. They've been saying it for months. We're not going to say anything to these people. They're so angry. We can't let any air out of the balloon. Well, that's how you get a really dangerous recipe in American politics. Unfortunately, we're all living through it right now.
I mean, Senator Fetterman is probably the only one. He's the Manchin of, I guess, this term. But I just do think that, you know, if Governor Beshear stepped up, you know, these people that are on the sideline, Governor Shapiro, and saying they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. You might not like it, but let law enforcement do their job. We just had Todd Lyons on, and he said not only are they leaving their masks on because they're being doxxed, it looks like ATF is going to do the same thing because for their own family's protection. Yet you had a governor in California says, if you do that, I'll arrest you. So can you imagine the LAPD trying to arrest an ICE agent? I don't think it's going to happen, but that's what he said.
Yeah, it's patently absurd. I mean, Shapiro is particularly disappointing. I mean, this guy's own house was firebombed, and he still can't speak any truth to the Democratic progressive base at this point. I mean, these things are crazy. Look, tomorrow, Chuck Schumer, the leader of the Senate and the Democrats, he's going to shut down the government because he can't tell his base that it's okay to keep the lights on in the Capitol. I mean, these people are in a really, really bad place. You're right. Fetterman might be the one who has said anything. But you're looking for real leadership and people who have microphones, and the elected leadership of Democrats are doing the exact opposite.
So that's what I want to get to. You work with Mitch McConnell for years. You know, he's been in charge of that minority majority leader, and he knows where you said he always can predict where this goes. As soon as Schumer got vilified for doing the right thing last time, and I rarely say that, he said, listen, we have no leverage here. We got to just do a continuing resolution. And they said, well, you're weak. And you let us down. I guess he wasn't honest with the House, who took a stand and gave speeches, and then he just acquiesced. So having said that, he knows. We're going to get blamed for this. But now, do you think tactically, PR-wise, Republicans will effectively message correctly here that they do have 54 votes in the Senate?
Yeah, I think they've already done the right thing in setting this up. You get it through the House, make it the Senate's problem, unify a Senate Republican conference, which Thune has done ably here, and then just point it to the Democrats. And what they're saying basically to the American people is, we're not going to give you any federal government service for any of your taxpayer dollars unless you make sure that we fund health care tax credits for illegal immigrants, that we revise all the waste, fraud, and abuse that we eliminated out of the Medicaid program. And, oh, by the way, what we really want is for you to refund NPR and PBS, because without a taxpayer-subsidized propaganda outfit, boy, our country can't live another day. It is just an outrageous deal. What I think they should do, Brian, is let these guys take the vote, hand the microphone over to Donald Trump, and let's see how it works out.
Because he's got a few ideas without a Congress that he could get done.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but I mean, there's never been a president who uses the bully pulpit more effectively than Trump does. And they just don't know what they've gotten themselves into. Look, I was in a lot of situations when I was up on Capitol Hill where Republicans had a bunch of really not great tactical decisions that put us in a difficult spot. But you have to know when to cut bait or before you make it worse. And this guy can't. He just can't do it. Schumer can't do it because he got AOC announcing she may run against him. He's terrified of that.
So why, you're 74 years old, can you ever do the right thing? Josh Holmes, co-host of the Ruthless Podcast, now part of the Fox family. Thanks so much, Josh. Did a great job on out number two. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, I'm Trey Gowdy, host of the Trey Gowdy Podcast. I hope you will join me every Tuesday and Thursday as we navigate life together and hopefully find ourselves a little bit better on the other side.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
Info
information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Now, young man, this is a very earnest young man. He doesn't look like a journalist to me, but go ahead and shout out a question because I'm not going to deny that level of energy and that level of passion. First of all, what's your name?
Henry.
It's good to meet you, Henry. Ask your question, please.
I skipped school today. I was wondering if I could get a picture with you.
Henry said, I skipped school. Can I have a picture with you? Well, I guess you got to have some excuse to skip school, so I might as well get a photo with Henry. Now the next reporter is going to be, hey, I'm from CNN. Can I get a photo with you, too? I wish that I got questions that easy. I'm not holding out hope.
That was funny. J.D. Vance yesterday, he was in North Carolina to talk about the subway system, the safety after the stabbing death of a Ukrainian woman who just wanted to go home. And then we had the ICE situation, so he was talking about that. And then finally he gets a break when a kid puts up his hand wearing Trump outfits and asks a question, can I get a picture with you because I'm skipping school today? That was so cool. Also, it shows he's a stupid politician and he's a guy. Hey, come on up here. You know, you don't do that if you're not comfortable in your own skin.
I'm Janice Dean. Join me every Sunday as I focus on stories of hope and people who are truly rays of sunshine in their community and across the world.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com. From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, where cars just go in the street and just sit there because 150 world leaders have been all over here because of the UN. And I guess we should be used to it. I always go in the subways. I have no problem with it. But in New York, everything stops when that happens. And everybody's in a rush and no one gets anywhere. And even if you're the French president, I don't know if anyone saw that video, but you see the French president caught in traffic, dying to get to the UN. He's got meetings and he can't get anywhere. And he calls the president of the United States. That's be a nice plus. Ali Raza Jeffersardia. Did I say that right? I probably didn't. He's the MEK guy. He's threat and deputy director of the National Council of Resistance of Iran, former MEK guy. He's going to talk about Iran's the president's speech yesterday. And Liz Claman's here in studio to talk about everything that's happened with the economy. But first, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
By the way, another piece of what is unprecedented and a bit historical about that race, it is the closest presidential race in the 21st century in terms of the outcome. Yeah.
No, it wasn't. Kamala's book tour reminds us daily how lucky we are that she lost as she struggles to communicate her own story written in her own book while attending her own party, while ripping up her own party and ripping her former boss.
Number two.
Well, it certainly is a switch from the position that President Trump earlier took with regard to Ukraine's prospects in the war with Russia. You'll recall he's changed his tune completely, and now he says not only that, that they can win the war and drive Russia out of the territory it has conquered since the invasion.
That is Brit Hume. Trump kicks Putin to the curb and goes all in for Ukraine. How this could actually save the West and the NATO alliance, we'll discuss.
Number one.
Masked men jumping out of unmarked cars, people disappearing, no due process, no oversight, zero accountability, happening in the United States of America today. People ask, well, is authoritarianism, you're being hyperbolic? Bull, we're being hyperbolic.
Will you stop pretending to be out of breath? ICE under attack, morning shootings, more protests, more irresponsible Democratic fear-mongering like you just heard from Gavin Newsom. It goes on the agents. That's why they wear masks. They are in severe danger. A sniper taking aim yesterday, still trying to unwind it today. And that's some of the things that are happening around the country. It's becoming a very dangerous place. Yet the politicians have become more and more reckless. Liz Claman joins us now. You know her from the Claman Countdown. You also has a fantastic podcast. Liz, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Well, Liz, we're trying to unwind where the economy's heading. I see Ray Dalio make a statement yesterday saying that he's really worried about the UK and the US because of our debt. He says people aren't buying our treasury bonds like they aren't buying our debt like they used to. Where do you fall? He's at the macro picture.
Okay, so he's been on my show, the Claman Countdown, and he said that we are heading toward an economic heart attack. The aorta is blocked. The widowmaker is now at 98% blocked. He's doing that analogy. And he does so by looking at the $36 trillion of debt that this country is groaning under. I get it. It feels less immediate to most people because they see the number and they see that we continue to borrow money, no matter who's in charge at the White House, Democrats, Republicans, and they just don't quite feel it. There will come a point, although nobody really knows when, that straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak, will hit. So when I think about what Ray Dalio is saying, he's not wrong. But at the moment, this economy is strong. We just in the last hour, Brian, got GDP for the second quarter. That's gross domestic product, in fancy term, the output of all goods and services. Not only did it hit the expected 3.3%, it jumped over it, came in at 3.8%. That is a two-year high for growth. Phenomenal. This is what we wanted to see. It's not some incremental 0.1%. And I really was so encouraged by that. Then we got durable goods. So durable goods, you guys, are the gigantic pieces of equipment that are supposed to last 3 to 5 years or hopefully more, like washing machines, dishwashers, cars, large trucks, things like that. That also beat by, you know, vaulting over. Wow. Very nice move. And so the economy looks good, which works as a negative for the stock market, which is down today and down yesterday and the day.
Because they want two more cuts this year.
Interest rate cuts come normally when you are worried that you need to stimulate the economy. This economy is on Red Bull at the moment. Let's say watered down Red Bull. Let's not be hyperbolic here. It's doing really, really well.
But not the job market. Are you still worried about that?
Well, first-time jobless claims, we get these every week. And this is the number you want to see come down because this is how many people joined the unemployment line for the first time. This also missed, but to the downside, fewer people joined the unemployment line last week and the week before, I think the week before. So suddenly you're looking at it saying, well, it's not that bad. And continuing claims, those are people who couldn't find a job last week, so are continuing to be on the job, you know, unemployment line. That also came in lower than expected. So that's a good sign.
What about jobs added? That's tomorrow?
Jobs added, is it? No.
Is that,
we're
is
getting PCE
products?
Tomorrow. We're getting the most important inflation number every month. This is August personal consumption expenditure. It's the Fed's favorite inflation gauge. And the one you want to look at, there are four levels to it. You don't want to look at the headline. You want to look at the core because that eliminates the, as they say, often volatile food and energy prices, which, of course, I don't know how they eliminate that. This is all that we need. Yeah. We need energy and we need food. But oil prices have been low, which is something President Trump promised. Your gasoline prices will stay low, and they pretty much have. Although we got some inventory numbers yesterday that showed a stronger than expected drawdown, meaning we need a bit more to fill those caverns that we have. So right now,
The emergency reserve?
Yeah, emergency reserves.
And usually when you say when the price of oil goes down, that's the time to fill it up.
Absolutely.
Right.
And
so why we're not doing that?
The Biden administration borrowed against the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which is for emergencies. And he did it in kind of a non-emergency time. Not smart.
Of course. But you know why he did that?
Yes, political reasons.
Because he doesn't want to drill, but he wants the oil and gas to stay low. And he wants to convince Venezuela, you're a horrible regime. If you promise to have fair elections, we're going to send Chevron back and we'll let you drill again. So he stopped Americans from drilling, but he didn't do anything for the environment. But he pretended like he did.
Yeah, let's always believe Maduro in Venezuela, who is...
And you're being sarcastic.
A murderer.
The worst.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the worst of the worst. He lost... He only got 30% of the vote last time. He probably didn't get 30, and he stayed.
People are in poverty, and I don't know if you guys have ever met Venezuelans. They're lovely people. And to think that they are, you know, they can't get their cafe de leche, and they, it's really upsetting. It's
right.
Very, very upsetting. And you look at this, and you say, these are the people. These are autocrats. These are terrible people.
So this is how I don't have that economics background, because when I think they're cutting the rates, it's going to help me at the bank getting a mortgage. And now people are telling me, don't look at that. You look at the treasuries,
yes.
The 10-year treasuries. Could you explain why?
So the 10-year treasury is what mortgage rates tend to follow. When the Federal Reserve cuts rates, This is what a lot of people don't understand. They're not cutting rates across the board. They're cutting a very specific interest rate. It's the overnight rate that the Fed charges banks to park their money. Now, quite frankly, that's a very low rate, way lower than any of us ever gets to pay. It's at 4 to 4.25 right now. I don't know about you guys, but the last time I looked at interest rates, they're anywhere from 6 to 8, yeah, or, depending on what you're doing. But your auto loans are much higher than that. So they cut that overnight rate. And why banks are getting such a fair rate just to park their money, that really should change, quite frankly. But that said, it tends to seep through, and then the 10-year starts to move. The 10-year's actually come down to just above 4%. Now, remember, it had been closer to 4.8 mm-hmm. several months ago. But mortgages are still pretty high, although they just recently hit a multi-year low of just above 6%. Which is good news.
Good news, except for we had incredible news prior. We were at 3.3 and 3.8%.
5 years ago.
You had, so when you have that middle-class family who says, you know, I need a bigger house, they go, well, not for 6%, I'm not. How does that make sense? If I'm going paycheck to paycheck in a good-sized house but like more room, there's not that incentive to put that dormer on mm-hmm. or to fix up your house because you got to go borrow money that's higher than the current mortgage that you have.
It's hard. The housing market's frozen because sellers don't want to move because they know if they move, they need to find a new place that's going to be at double the 3%. It'll be at 6-something percent. And sellers don't want to buy because psychologically they don't remember back when I was buying my first house, I got a 6.4% mortgage and I thought I was doing great.
Right, compared to the 13s that we had during the Carter
year.
And
my sister had an 8% years and years ago and she thought she was doing great.
So you like the signs, but it's bad. The market doesn't because the market feels as though the Fed is not going to cut rates and that's what the market would like to see.
You do understand economics. The Fed uses interest rates as a tool. Dry powder, think of it like that. You use it to stimulate the economy in times of emergency, mm-hmm. like the pandemic, where we cut rates way down to the bone. The issue is, right now, we don't want to use up, or the Fed doesn't want to use up that dry powder right now to satisfy, look, President Trump has pushed hard for it. He wants to see lower rates.
I haven't noticed.
You haven't noticed?
Yeah, I really, yeah.
But the fact is, if you're really looking at this, the economy is strong. You don't cut rates.
Did it bother you when Steve Miron came out as a now on the Fed board and said, I'm for cutting rates, a bunch of rates, even more than that. I was for doing more of a rate cut last time, kind of a bit of a heretic against the chairman.
Little bit.
That bother you?
A little bit.
Is that unprecedented?
Not unprecedented, but very unusual in the past several cycles. In the past several cycles. Well, he's talking President Trump's book. Let's just be honest. Now, would it kill us to cut rates another 0.25%?
No.
Nope, it would not. But think about it. You want to have foresight. 7 years of feast, 7 years of famine. During the feast, you fill the cellar with potatoes and preserves. Back in the olden days, right? Little House on the Prairie, Laura Ingalls Wilder. You saved for when the winter comes and you know it's coming.
But you know the winter might not happen when Trump's in office and Trump's concerned about his 4 years.
Of course. So keep that in mind.
And, absolutely.
You know, it's unfortunate. All politicians, they just look in the 2 year, you know, same with the House.
Midterms.
Two year. That's it.
So a couple of things. Treasury Secretary has met with the Argentinian leader who has done amazing things with the Argentinian economy. Mm-hmm. He's did some radical things, but it looks like they need a bailout and he might be getting it from us. Listen.
The plan is, as long as President Milei continues with his strong economic policies to help him, to bridge him to the election, you know, I call this the screens moving to the streets. We are not going to let a disequilibrium in the market cause his a backup in his substantial economic reforms. I don't think the market has lost confidence in him. I think the market is looking in the rearview mirror and is looking at decades, if not a century, of terrible Argentinian mismanagement. And you know, people are concerned. People are skittish. It's very hard to believe that it is different this time. But I believe with President Milei, it is.
So what do they need from us?
Why are we even considering using American money to prop up somebody else's currency if we're not in a total emergency? This seems like a political emergency. He even said it. We want to stretch it till the election. And through the years, Argentina has been a problem child. A lot of the South American countries have been problem children. Are we going to go down and start bailing out other countries? Like, I mean, if they get into trouble, this is really, really strange. And
especially because China's got a huge presence there. Are we using that as leverage to push China out?
Well, you could also.
No, they have rare earth,
well,
too.
Yeah. But and look, I get that Malay has done great things for the economy. Well, what's wrong with their currency? Oh, it was the last guy. So why are we getting in the middle of that? Especially when people are already complaining about why are we paying to give money for vaccines to Africa when our country needs the money? Well, our country needs the money. Why are we giving it to Argentina right now?
We get it back? I mean, do we get it with interest? Or
well, you
let's
just
hear about
don't
it.
Know.
Yeah. When people say the worry is goods are, I know we're waiting on the inflation number, but I do hear on anecdotal ways that prices are up and that people say, you know, this is the beginning of some tariff impact. Liz, what do you think?
Yes. But we just don't know. And it's been a surprise.
Because we are getting revenue.
Now, that is a cop-out, Liz. Why did you just say we just don't know? We actually do. So Scott Bessent is absolutely correct. We have not seen the tariffs bleed over into the greater price economy. However, I cover these guys every day. Walmart, Hasbro, Mattel, tons of companies have come out and said, second half, which is where we are right now, we're done shouldering all of this cost. We may have to start hiking prices. And we probably will.
With the holiday season.
Exactly. And prices of materials. Like today, I have the largest cement and concrete maker in the world, CRH. Okay, they do all the roads in America, everything. They do huge tunnels in Switzerland, and they do the stormwater system for LAX. I'm going to ask him about his pricing because this stuff is getting expensive. For the average person listening right now, look at your utility bill. Why, when we have more natural gas pumped out right now, this country is just swimming
in it. Well, that wouldn't be tariff.
But everything passes through. And the equipment used to dig for it and to extract it, some of that material comes from overseas.
Oh, okay.
And it's sort of that domino effect. And we may very well see it. Now, I would argue, if you asked any of your listeners, have things come down in price? Nope. They may have stayed static.
Right.
But I haven't seen anything at the market come down. I mean, why am I buying a box of crackers for $3?
Right.
Really? It used to be $1.70 or $2, even at Walmart.
Yeah, we'll see what say. Yeah, I don't blame the supermarket owners, as some people do.
It's a business.
Yeah, but they can't wait when New York gets their own supermarket, when New York City is running their own supermarket.
Oh, yes, of course.
It's going to be great
yes.
for us.
It'll be wonderful, and there will be stocked shelves, and yeah, right.
Liz, who's going to be on your show?
Okay, CRH CEO. You've never heard of them. You drive on their roads every single day.
Gotcha.
They are, I call him the Concrete King. He's coming on. Kodiak Truck just went public. This is an American company based in California. They have rolled out totally autonomous, gigantic trucks in West Texas, 8 of them moving around so you don't pay. There's a truck driver shortage. You don't pay the truck drivers health care, whatever, because you can't find enough truck drivers. And they don't fall asleep at the wheel, et cetera.
Right.
So those guys are coming on. And Qualcomm CEO, they have just come out with a chip that will be 100 times faster than human thought.
Wow, that's even faster than my thought. That includes me, too. 3 o'clock. The Klayman Countdown,
yes.
FBN.
Don't
Thanks
miss
so
it.
Much, Liz Klayman.
We're making you guys money, hopefully.
Back in a moment.
You're with Brian Kilmeade.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
We are back, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. You got to make sure all the televisions are off trying to watch all the breaking news that's happening this week, especially over at the UN. This, don't forget, just a quick note, I'm going to be in Richmond, Virginia, WRBA. I'm going to be coming up there Saturday night. Hope to see everybody in person and everybody in the surrounding area. Tell one, come one, come all. It'll be go to BrianKilmeade.com. One of the so when we come back, I'm going to be talking to the former head of the MEK, now deputy director of the National Council of Resistance on Iran. I want to get his take on the president of Iran's remarks yesterday that they never, ever wanted to build a nuclear weapon. We'll see how that's going to go. And don't forget, Saturday night and November 1st in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, History, Liberty, and Laughs. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Shortly after taking office, I sent the so-called Supreme Leader a letter making a generous offer. I extended a pledge of full cooperation in exchange for a suspension of Iran's nuclear program. The regime's answer was to continue their constant threats to their neighbors and U.S. interests throughout the region and some great countries that are right nearby.
That is the president of the United States, and he's 100% right. When he took over, much of the chagrin of many people, because they wanted him to go down with full sanctions on Iran, he said, listen, let's talk. Let's get this thing going. And it went five rounds. When he realized they were just spinning their wheels, he took action, and the Israelis took the lead, and we finished off their nuclear program, which I'm sure they're to a level they're rebuilding. But they have to do it with very little financing, with sanctions fully on. They're waiting to see if the Europeans are going to put them back on, if they are a fact in violation of the President Obama-era plan that would have allowed him to reconstitute after 10 years. My guest is Ali Raza Jafarzadeh. He is the author of The Iran Threat and Deputy Director of the National Council of Resistance of Iran and part of the big protest outside the United Nations to show you how unwelcome the Iranian president was to the Iranians who have gotten out of that country and are here.
Absolutely, Brian. You should have been there to see the level of enthusiasm.
You show me the crowds. How many people were there?
There were thousands of them. And they came for 2 days. And remember, it wasn't the weekend. During the weekday, both on Tuesday and Wednesday, the first day of General Assembly, and also the second day when Pezeshkian spoke. And they spoke very loud and clear, rejecting the regime, but also talking about the alternative, saying Iran does have an alternative. They talked about Mrs. Maryam Rajavi, who heads the president-elect of the National Council of Resistance. They talked about her 10-point plan for the future of Iran, saying that the future of Iran is going to be based on separation of religion and state, equality between men and women, freedom of religion, freedom of political parties, freedom of the press, free market economy, and peace in the Middle East.
That's what you'd like,
non-nuclear Iran.
But it's not close right now. Unless you believe that this country, after the bombings and the humiliation, as Israel went with impunity in bombing out their sites and taking out their leaders, that they're ready to collapse. Do you believe they're ready to collapse?
Well, look, in a country like Iran with about close to 90 million population, a huge country, change has to come from within by the people on the ground. And that's the role of the organized resistance in Iran. We've talked about the MEK resistance units on the ground. This is the same movement that exposed all the major nuclear sites of Iran, exposed their missile program, has been the main target of the killings inside Iran, but also the target of the terrorism of the Iran regime outside. They're part of this coalition, the National Council of Resistance of Iran, as the alternative. So, of course, you need to build pressure on the regime. So far, the policy of appeasement in the past 2-3 decades has significantly helped the regime to maintain power, but get money and cash and rewarded for their terrorism. That era, I believe, has ended. Now you just have the United Nations basically voting to snap back all the sanctions back on the Iran regime within 2 days. And proxies of the regime have been either shattered or so weak in the region. Assad, their biggest ally, is gone. Their nuclear program that they spend, it costs around $2 trillion for their nuclear program. It's all gone. So inside Iran, you've had these rounds of major uprisings since 2018 in all 31 provinces. People want change.
Because you said they don't have water. The infrastructure is falling apart. I want you to hear the president yesterday, the president of Iran yesterday, cut 26.
You all bore witness that this past June, my country was subjected to a savage aggression in flagrant contravention of the most elementary principles of international law. The aerial assaults of the Zionist regime and the United States of America against Iran's cities, homes, and infrastructures, precisely at a time when we were treading the path of diplomatic negotiations, constituted a grave betrayal of diplomacy and a subversion of efforts towards the establishment of stability and peace.
So a grave betrayal of diplomacy and subversion, because they had a six-round schedule, but they weren't doing anything, and they were denying their nuclear program.
Well, the language of diplomacy, as far as the Iran regime is concerned, is translating to terrorism. The terrorism is the cornerstone of their foreign policy, and they have been doing it consistently for years. They went after the Iranian dissidents outside of the country in
Europe. Have they targeted you?
Yeah, here. In 2018, two agents of the Iran regime were arrested by the FBI, and, you know, they were targeting Iranian opposition leaders. I was part of it. And also, they were the number one killer of American forces in Iraq, sending those EFPs across the border.
Which are IEDs on steroids.
Exactly. And, you know, you name it. There is a reason that the regime is the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism, designated as such for nearly four decades. And now they talk about diplomacy. I mean, what does diplomacy mean when they threaten and they kill people? They take people hostage. Their diplomacy is actually hostage diplomacy. They take foreign nationals hostage in exchange for getting money or the terrorists that they were caught. Right. On behalf of Tehran. That's what they've been doing in the past few years. That's why I think an end should be put to all of those things. Look at Iran through the prism of the Iranian people, the organized resistance. They are the true representatives of the people, the true voice of the nation. Mm-hmm. They are the real counterparts of the outside world. And that was on display during this two-day rally across from the UN.
Here's more from their president, Cut 25.
I hereby declare once more before this assembly that Iran has never sought and will never seek to build a nuclear bomb. We do not seek nuclear weapons. This is our belief based on the edict issued by the supreme leader and by religious authorities. Therefore, we never sought weapons of mass destruction, nor will we ever seek them. Whereas those who disturb the peace and stability in the region lies in Israel, but Iran is the one that is being punished for those actions. There is a poem that roughly says something to the effect that someone in one side of the world does something to disturb the peace and someone else is punished for those actions. Ladies and gentlemen, the Islamic Republic of Iran welcomes peace and stability.
Yeah, so they never, ever wanted to pursue a nuclear weapon, and it's Israel that doesn't want peace.
Well, it's very interesting that, you know, since 2002, when we first revealed the nuclear site in Natanz, which, by the way, they had never declared it, we exposed it, and that got the IAEA inspections going, and then we exposed the underground facility in Fardo under the mountains where they were building centrifuges. And until since
you guys were the ones who found it, the MEK found it.
Exactly. We found it. We and consistently, you know, there have been 130 plus cases of exposures of their nuclear program, their sites, their projects. And yet every time the regime came back and said, oh, this is nothing. This is all lies. The IAEA had found a lot of traces of highly enriched uranium on the ground. They're just explaining it away. They kicked IAEA out of the country. There's no explanation that is plausible, according to the IAEA, for a number of tests that they had done.
Right now, they're not allowed in. And so we don't know how much damage that we did. Do you? Do you know?
No one knows. But obviously, I mean, it's always impossible to get back to where they were. I think the regime used a very special historical circumstances in the past two decades to develop their nuclear weapons to go that far, taking advantage of the policy of appeasement. And but that situation is now over. It's not going to repeat itself. So I think, but does that mean that they have given up their nuclear weapons program? Absolutely not. This is a tool for their survival. Right. So I think this is a time for everybody.
What do you recommend to push them over the edge? you know, without violating international law? What would push them over the edge? We look at Maduro's regimes on life support, the Iranian regimes on life support. What would get them out once and for all, the Ayatollah? Because you said he came out and said something significant.
Yeah, he basically rejected.
Belligerence. Yeah.
He rejected the United States, you know, having dialogue with the U.S. He said, we're not going to back down from 60% enrichment of uranium. We're not going to back down on any of our policies. I think this is an opportunity for the international community, particularly the Trump administration, to look at Iran through the prism of the people of Iran. There is an alternative. There is an organized force who doesn't require boots on the ground, foreign boots on the ground, or appropriation of money or arms, none of that. That policy that before would just try to work with the regime has to change. That policy need to shift to recognizing the right of the people in Iran to overthrow the mullahs, the right of those resistance units to confront the Revolutionary Guards. That's where the change will come. It's imminent. Right. You have the Iranian people on your side. You have the momentum shifting in this direction. That's the only path that hasn't been tried, by the way, Brian, and this is the time to do it.
I would love to try it. Ali Raza Jafarzadeh, thanks so much for coming in. Continue to be safe as Deputy Director of the National Council of Resistance of Iran. Hopefully we'll talk to you from Tehran one of these days.
That will happen soon.
Back in a moment.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Jason Chaffetz from the Jason in the House podcast. Join me every Monday to dive deeper into the latest political headlines and chat with remarkable guests.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com
or wherever you download podcasts.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
The president's kind of funny. He loves the game of golf. He loves supporting golfers. And I get a call or a text from him sometimes after wins. And he just loves the game of golf. And he's one of those guys, when you're around him, you know, he does such a good job of almost like feeding confidence into everybody around him. That was one of the things I noticed a lot with the little bit of time I spent him is he treats everybody the same and treats people with the utmost respect. And whether you're the person serving us lunch or the caddy on the golf course or the guy who's the president of the club that we're at, he treats everybody like they're the greatest person in the world. And I don't think he has any plans to address us as a team, but I'm sure if things go well, we'll hear from him.
Are you able to give us any insight into what he says when he calls you?
Great job.
Scotty Scheffler wins a lot, and he must be getting great job calls and great text calls a lot from the President of the United States, who loves golf and loves athletes, really appreciates it because everything that goes into it, the grit, performing under pressure, the training that goes into it, the discipline that's required. So Scotty Scheffler, that's something that would happen 4 years ago. They're like, oh, don't bring our President Trump. Remember, the PGA took their tournaments out of his golf courses and took their majors out of Scotland. I thought that was just terrible at the time, and I still think it was. But it looks like all's forgiven, as he also has a relationship with Liv. And now it is the Ryder Cup, which is not individuals, not a tournament. It is U.S. against the Europeans. And which is interesting is most of them don't play in the European League, you know, the European tour. They all play here. A lot of them live here, but it's still where you're born against all of Europe against just us. And I believe they won the last one. It is out in Bethpage, Long Island, where I live, Bethpage Black, which has been the home of U.S. Opens in the past. And what is interesting is yesterday, all the New York officials showed up. And you guys don't know it yet. Most of you think New York City is New York, but there's upstate New York, which is like Iowa and Long Island, which is diverse as it gets. It's not just the Hamptons, it's Queens. And one thing is pretty clear. This governor hates Long Island. He doesn't get any votes from there. They're trying to take all the American Indian names off the schools. We've been telling you about that. And they're also trying to jam in government housing into neighborhoods because it's not diverse enough for them. So here she is getting introduced at the Ryder Cup on Long Island.
Keep it going for New York. Your friend and mine in attendance, Governor Kathy Hochul. Governor, thank you so much for being here. And thank you to your team, too, for getting us ready for the Ryder Cup in New York.
I would like to say a few thank yous to Governor of State New York, Kathy Hochul.
As we prepare to tee it up on Friday, I want to thank the people who made this journey possible. To Governor Hochul, to the teams of New York, to the teams of the New York State Parks.
And that's got to make Elise Stefanik feel good. And I'm going to keep that when you get her back on. Because, you listen, what happens is Lee Zeldin, everyone said, oh, there's no, it's impossible outside George Pataki. That's an anomaly in New York. Everyone left. It's a Republican. So they'll never have a Republican win. And then Lee Zeldin got within 5 points of Kathy Hochul, who's an accidental governor since Cuomo couldn't keep his hands off every woman he saw. So he got thrown out of office. So she becomes and wins barely over Zeldin. Now, Elise Stefanik, very popular in upstate New York, and now a national figure who was supposed to be UN ambassador, but they needed her seat. So she had to go back and win it, and she stayed there. And now she says, I'm going to try to be governor. Remember, she tore up Columbia University presidents and Harvard's presidents and got enlightened everyone to the anti-Semitism raging on campuses. And she is such a fighter. She's going to tear Kathy Hochul up. By the time they get to the actual debate, if it is not a flat-footed tie, I'd be shocked. Right now, she's trailing by double digits, but she'll close that quickly. And that'll be not happening this year, but the year after, especially after this mayor screws up New York City, if he does, in fact, win. And then you know that Kathy Hochul endorsed this communist, Marxist, at the very least, socialist. So we'll keep you up to date on what's happening there, along with the Virginia race. President of the United States still meeting with the president of Turkey. And when he does what he does best, he comes out with Turkey's president there and says, I want him to stop buying Russian oil and gas right in front of him. So I love it. I'm not sure he will, because he considers himself friends with Vladimir Putin. One of the quotes with, I believe it's with Brett Baer, was, we hit it off immediately when we met. Isn't that nice? I want you to listen and bring to something else that kills me. And I love that Jason Kelce brought it up. So you know he is the Eagles offensive lineman who's now retired. Brother Travis, you know all this stuff. He's got a great podcast. He's on the New Heights podcast. And he brought up something that really bothers me. And that's Roger Goodell and the new in the league in trying to stay up with, I guess, the dearth of numbers and people have preferences coming out of college, has allowed anyone to get any number regardless of the position. And it's confusing. When you see a team you don't know before you watch, is that a defensive lineman? Is that a great play? Is that a linebacker? Is that a stand-up? You know, you don't even know anymore. So listen to Jason Kelce talk about this. Cut 43.
I just don't like the whole numbers. I really liked that you could tell, just as like a fan, I really liked by like even like watching a jersey, looking at a jersey.
I want a quarterback to wear 99.
See, I don't want that. I liked looking at a jersey and knowing without even knowing the guy what position that guy played. There was something about the numbers signifying what position you played in that I just liked. I don't know. I just was a fan of it. I don't like that now the numbers mean nothing on defense. Anybody can wear whatever the they want. And then on offense, you still have ineligible numbers.
It's true. I liked it the old way, and it just made it easier as part of the game. And as part of when you're teaching the game, you have people checking out the game. You look at the wide receiver and you go, what is that? Is that an outside back? You know, is that a running back? Is that a slot receiver? I don't know. So I wish you would go back. I hope they could. And lastly, though, I want to go back to the earlier soundbite. Do you see what Scottie Scheffler said? He said he treats everyone great, but he talks about the waiter, the parking his car, the guy who cleans the golf carts and the clubs. He treats everybody great. Now, he's never going to run for election again. Understand that. That one quality, people want to point out negative qualities to the president all the time, and some people won't give him any credit. But one of the people they always say, how do you treat people you need nothing from? And he grades off the charts. And that's why when we went to Atlantic City and we were out there and that's going to clubs and buildings he used to own, a lot of people are still there and they talk about how well the 40-year-old mogul future president treated them and their family and how they knew all of their he knew all the kids' names. Don't forget, I want to see everybody in Virginia, 48 hours, 7 o'clock in Richmond, Virginia, BrianKilmeade.com to get tickets so you can watch on the stream on Fox Nation Saturday Night, History, Liberty, and Laughs.
It's Will Cain Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday at FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.